Okay. All right, so just to get our heads back into it, since we do it for the past 2 weeks, we're again at the beginning of chapter 8, and the first few thoughts that, principles that King Solomon laid down was that nobody compares to a wise individual because he understands the interpretation of a matter, meaning that since everything is a creation of the intelligent creator, so anything that we encounter and how we interact with it in our existence has to be with wisdom if we're going to have a true perception and a successful encounter with whatever phenomena we interact with, that are people, whatever events, whatever life throws our way. So the first thing it says is that the intelligence is required, and that nobody compares to the wise person, because he knows how to fare well through, you know, any event. Doesn't mean that he's flawless. Every person has flaws, but nobody compares to him. That's the first point. All right, so that's just in terms of interaction with reality. And then he said the second point was that that wisdom of a person illuminates his face. That means to say that we are designed, that that gives us the greatest enjoyment. We have a sense of, how do we say it? When we see something is true and real, that gives us the greatest satisfaction. And we're designed that way because this is what God really wants. If we had a greater attachment to sin, so then it would be impossible for God to tell us to avoid sin. So it must be that we are designed in a way where we will have the most illuminated faces, meaning the most pleasant state of existence when we are attached to reality, because perceiving reality is going to afford us that highest level of enjoyment. And because by nature we can tell the difference between what's real and what's not, and by nature we're attached to what's real. It's not something that has to be learned, but by nature a person is going to be attached to what is real. And that's just in terms of enjoyment, in terms of the most pleasant disposition will be achieved through wisdom. And third was that the wisdom will change the brazenness of a person's face. And then we're talking about ego. And that's a very big component in a person's life, is that he's always pushing forth his ego, his status, and you can see it. It's not something you have to really have to dig for. When people talk, and the tones, and what bothers them, the fact that people have intolerance, all this is a display of ego. But when a person's involved in wisdom, and he sees something greater than himself, so now all his futile attempts, his constant strivings for ego will fall away because he sees there's something greater than himself. And the truth is, in life, 99% of the time, the person's attempts for ego fail. Or he needs certain situations to have the satisfaction. It's not enough just to imagine that people think of him a certain way. He has to do certain things. We talked about buying fancy cars and building, fantastic homes, all this in order that he can imagine that people will have a certain applause for him. And even at that, it's still an imagination that he has. So people live in order that they can imagine something is true. And it's really fraught with frustration. And then he goes on to the second verse, and he says that the words of the king, meaning God, I keep. So King Solomon is telling you that he's guarding God's words, because since this is wisdom, this is from God, and he's following through himself. So he's using himself as an example. And on the words of the swear of the judge, meaning to say that the Torah was taken in by the Jews as an obligation. We accepted it upon ourselves. Now, we said after that, what's going to naturally happen is that there's going to be a certain rebellion. And that's what he talked about in the next verse, where he says, in 3, do not be excited to leave the presence of God. Don't be excited to leave from before him. Don't stand in an evil matter. For all that he desires, he does. three ideas. So we, again, just as a review, why is it that the person gets excited to leave from before God, as opposed to other phenomena, other events, other confrontations? Because being before God presents obligation on a person. And if a person now wants to leave from before that, what does that tell you? It tells you that the person is rebellious. He wants to have complete autonomy, freedom to do what I want, when I want. That's basically an infantile type of a thing, to one child going over to another child and taking his toy. There's no rules. I do what I want. And this is something which, if it's not curbed, it could really ruin the child. So a person, and many people, I should say not a person, but many people still carry this type of unconscious feeling that and you hear it from people, when you speak to them, you know, do you keep the Torah or not? And they say no. And the justification is, look, God just wants me to be a good person. So they know that there's a law, but they also want freedom. So they create something which is, of course, false. And it's a denial of all the laws that exist. And they just, God just wants me to be good. As long as we're good, that's all that matters. Even though God never said that. But that's an expression. That's an example of the attempt of a person to have that freedom. And King Solomon is telling you, do not be excited for before God, to leave before his presence. Excitement means, meaning coming from that ego that he talked about in the first verse, that a person learns and he studies the Torah system, so then it will change, it will alter that brazenness that he has, that natural disposition of egocentricity. So he tells you not to act on that, because there is that desire to abandon it. So the rabbis say that when the Jews left Sinai, they left like a child leaving the school, running away. We just want to get the heck out of here. Meaning the obligations that were imposed upon them were something which were very troublesome to them. Even after the event, even after witnessing it, it still imposed a vice grip on their ability to choose what they were going to do now they had all these laws. So that'll be the natural response. If you go to a person and you, who's had the freedom to do what he wants, when he wants, and now you give him a whole bunch of laws, it's going to have a restricting feel, for sure. But that's only emotionally restricting. And we said that King Solomon went on in this verse, and he said, don't stand in evil matter, meaning to say that if you do go from before God, so then it's going to be an evil matter that you'd be involved in. Because if God gives you instruction, then you decide to do something, anything but God's instruction, so it must be something which is going to be negative. Because you're avoiding what really is the good. And he concluded that verse number 3 by saying, for all that God desires, he does. There is, I think Ibn Ezra says, he's telling you that there is a punishment that you can't escape. So that's more in terms of authoritative statement. And that's really where we ended. That's how far we got so far. Okay. So far so good? This is a review.
Yeah, Rabbi, when you had talked about how it enlightens the face or something like that, in 2, I think it was?
1.
Illuminated.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that would also, from an internal and an external, a person who is seeing truth, their eyes are more clear. Like you can really see into them instead of being clouded over.
Right, they're very certain what they have. They don't seem preoccupied or distracted, you mean?
Right.
Yes, for sure. It definitely has an inner. He's talking about the inner. Perfection, the inner enjoyment, and definitely is going to be expressed outwardly. You're right. Perhaps that's why he says it lightens the face, because that really is an expression of the inner enjoyment. When the person is seems to be such a happy disposition, a happy expression on the face, that the person falls in love, or they had success, and you can see it on their face. They're happy. They're at ease. A lot of the stress is gone. Their eyebrows are not, hitting the ceiling. You can see that they're very natural. person's alarmed. It's like their eyebrows are always like high up on their forehead, and you can see just from the expression what that something's brewing, something's disturbing them. Okay. But now he says further in 4, he says, for whatever the king speaks, he rules. And who's going to tell him what to do? For upon anything which God spoke, the king again, you see? King, he's using the term because of rule, of God giving a rule, God giving a system. But what is he addressing when he says, who's going to tell him what to do? What is that addressing in the person? What attitude?
Arrogance.
Okay.
Maybe the natural resistance to do something that somebody else tells them to do.
Right. Right, because he said already that in the end of 3, that for whatever he desires, he does. But that, you could say, is limited just to a direct response to an infraction. So if you do go against God, and you're going to be standing upon an evil matter, meaning to say, if you leave God's presence, if you just read 3 again, he says, don't be excited. Don't let the arrogance and the emotion excite you to rebel and to leave God's presence. That's not a good thing. Why? Because then it'll end up that you'll be ending up in an evil matter. He says, don't stand it upon an evil matter. That must be the natural result. If you abandon what God tells you, it must be you're doing something which would be hurtful to yourself. But there he only tells you, it gives you a stimulus not to do it because of a punitive response. For all that God desires, he will do. And now he expands upon that idea that all he desires, and he says, not only in terms of responding to your individual infraction, but upon anything which the king spoke, he rules. And who's going to tell him what to do?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
We talking just halakha here?
No. Because anything God spoke about includes both halacha, law, and philosophy. What's perfecting for a person, what's not.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about the idea that halacha is, black and white in one sense. I mean, obviously there are questions of halacha that have to be decided, but once it's decided, it's like, okay, you do this or you do this. And if I do this, then I'm following God's rule. But when it's in philosophy, it seems like there's a whole lot of grayness about, the individual psyche, their circumstances, what might be best for them, what might not be best for them, and so forth. And so I'm just trying to kind of get a handle on how that's applied here. Is it just, you study and learn and operate, on the best of your ability, and yeah, you may get better wisdom at a later point, and then you change course a little bit, and it's a constantly adjusting mechanism as you go along.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's not as clear and cut as what actions you must do in terms of Jewish law, halacha. But philosophy definitely has its parameters. There's definitely clear parameters there. I mean, it is true that everybody has a different situations and how it's applied in your specific circumstance. That for sure will be and even in halacha, you have that. There's a certain law applying in this case or that case, or what if this comes up? Because there definitely are many variables. But his point is that a person's natural rebellion against it, wanting to have that freedom, is something which is going to hurt him. So he shouldn't act on it in an individual case. But And that we could say is perhaps the is the third the verse 3, because there's something punitive that can go on. But I mean, punitive also is in terms of the philosophy too. But it seems to be in there, it's more of an isolated case. It's saying don't be excited upon a certain thing and then enter into a certain matter. But now he wants to give you a broader picture. And he says, for all that the king has spoken on, he rules. That means to say in every matter. And that's, again, making it even more difficult. It may cause more of a rebellion, but this has to be said. Because the king's, King Solomon's point over here is that it's true you have a sense of wanting to have freedom, but what is the best thing and what is really true? Well, God already spoke. He already created. When he said that on that which the king spoke, he rules, meaning to say everything which exists, the entire universe is a reflection of his will. That means there are certain ways that it works, and this is everywhere. So now he says this fills up all points in the universe. There's no area. So it's really restricting the person, but at the same time, he's trying to give a picture to the person that all areas are going to be they're going to be operating by certain rules. And to deviate, who are you? Meaning at the end of the verse where he says, who is going to hell? Now he brings in the human consideration. But why is he bringing it in? Because he's trying to pronounce the idea that you are just a puny human being. So who are you that you're going to tell God what to do? He created a universe and a reality, and it may be that you don't like certain things about it, but his main thrust is that look at what your position is and his position. I use the example a lot of you can't go to Henry Ford and tell him that he made the first Ford automobile incorrectly. There's no blueprint. That is the blueprint. That first Ford is the first Ford. So he wasn't matching it to something else. If I later on decide to make a copy of the Ford, then somebody could tell me I did something wrong in terms of trying to replicate the Ford. I made the wrong moves, the wrong design, because there is a blueprint already. So here also, he's telling you that God made the blueprint. He is the creator of the universe. That is the reality. So now he's trying to show the fundamental reason why the person should not, there may be gray areas, it's true, but the real rule to come away with is that if he created the reality, it's not for me to say he did it wrong, it's for me to follow it. And it's true that there may be some difficulty in how it's applied at times. And there may be, more gray areas or, less defined boundaries. Because it's not talking about a discrete action, it's talking about more of ideas. So maybe that's what you're getting at, Doug, that it's grayer, it's fuzzier edges. That, in terms of halakha, I know I have to do this. I have to lift this up, move it to the right, put it down. I have to shake the lulav, I have to put the tefillin on the left arm if I'm righty. Whatever, and I get very clear cut, so it's very, it's something which I could, feel secure that I'm making the right moves. How do you do it in philosophy? It takes more. You're right. But you see that the lesson is that you can equally tell a person that they would not be foolish enough to disobey a doctor who's telling him you have to do these, take these 10 steps for your health or else you'll die. So they are a person, they'll be very quick to admit their ignorance and follow the doctor. It's not so in the case of, philosophy. The person doesn't see, number one, the results right away of a bad move. Number two, the immortality fantasy. A person is not even convinced he's going to die. He says other people dying. He even, goes to pay a shiva call, somebody passed away, so he even goes to the house and he comforts the mourners. But he leaves, he goes back to his life, and all he knows is being here on earth and everything going on a certain pattern daily. So there's a certain denial of that too. So that makes it harder to really think that, what real value, why should I forfeit my freedom and follow philosophy? There are a lot of considerations. But you see what he's doing in this verse, though.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sure. And you see, it's following. There's a really nice flow. It's clear how he's moving along over here, in terms of addressing. And you see, even in the next verse, he now gives a certain consolation, because now that he just told you everything which God created, who could tell him what to do? Meaning, you have no position after you came. You're actually a created thing. So the Creator already put together this entire universe, and you're going to say he did it wrong? You're part of what he created. That itself should be a blow to the ego. But you see, he says in verse 5, those who guard the mitzvahs, those who keep God's commands, will not know anything evil. And there is a time for justice, and this is known by the heart of a wise man. I mean, there's a time and there's justice to all this in terms of the laws.
Rabbi?
Yes.
When it talks about he will know no evil, is that in the personal experience? Because we look around and we see evil things being done in the world, but is it like he will not personally experience evil?
Well, it's good you mention that, because Ibn Ezra says this is the majority rule. Sometimes things come up, even though a person is righteous and living the proper life, and you don't have knowledge of all the variables and what's going on. So, but the majority rule is, and you'll agree with this, that if a person will, I'll give you an example. Say a person has a certain amount of ingredients, and he's a cook, and he properly cooks a chicken at a certain temperature at the right amount of time, and puts the right type of basting on it, the dough in the oven he kneads with a certain amount of yeast, certain amount of water content, certain measure of dough, and he puts it in the oven at a certain temperature, also a certain amount of time. So he follows all the parameters and how things interrelate, and he does this properly, so then he'll have good results all the time. Now, there may be certain things that come up. Maybe it's humid one day in the kitchen, and he didn't anticipate that, and that now affects it, and the dough doesn't rise, or whatever the parameters are. But in general, all things being equal, the same thing happens with a person who's following the Torah, that the system has a certain effect it'll have on the person in terms of perfecting him, taming his instincts, imbuing him with additional ideas that are pleasing. And this is going, and also by using intelligence, and he becomes wise, he sees how the world operates, and he stops trying to fight City Hall, and he does things properly, and he works with how the world operates. So he will have a greater, his life will be smoother. That doesn't mean there aren't certain variables that come up that are he didn't anticipate, so on and so forth. But that's what Ibn Ezra says, the general rule. But it's a general rule for the majority of the time, he says. Let's see if Swarno says on that. He says as follows, and he keeps to his theme about, because he says earlier, Swarno says earlier on 3, where he says, don't be excited at the fact that there's so many commands, that you should leave before God's presence, meaning abandon the mitzvahs. Don't do that. Without understanding the ideas of the mitzvahs, meaning their ideas there, in a manner that you would turn from fulfilling them without knowing the ideas. And he says, don't stand on this matter. I mean, you don't consider that the Torah is like that, where it's without reason. And that's what he says. He says, don't stand on this thought, this evil thought, that God, blessed be he, that he does something without any reasoning or without any purpose. That's foolish. And he goes on and he says, one who keeps a command will not see something evil. That's what we're up to now. So what does he say on that? As Swarno says, one who guards the commands and he ponders upon the ideas of the mitzvahs, he will not find anything evil, that they're lacking any type of purpose that is proper. For God is good in all of his works. And he goes on and he says, the second part of that verse where it says that the heart of the wise man knows the time and the justice of something. What does Sforno say that means? He knows and he understands the time that was given for a certain command and the justice in it and the reasoning. Why was it given? Meaning to say, what does he mean he knows there's a time and a place for certain things? What is that addressing in the person? What's the incorrect notion that King Solomon is now addressing when he says that the one who has a wise heart knows there's a time and place? He's trying to correct some incorrect notion there. What is that incorrect notion he's trying to correct?
Rabbi, my translation says the heart of a wise man knows time and justice.
Right.
So is it referring to that the truly wise man understands two things? First of all, he understands the concept of justice and what's appropriate to do in the realm of justice in the world and society, and so he's aware of the impact of his actions, not only just, you know, in on him, but on other people who may be affected by it, including his whole society. And he knows that there's a time and a place for different things, and so that you may do one thing in one time, one thing in another time, depending on the circumstances, and he's analyzing each situation to determine what's best to do in that situation.
Exactly. What you're saying is basically what Ibn Ezra says. He says that the person who has a wise heart, because he knows that for every desire, there's a time, and he doesn't enter to battle with a person when he is being very successful. So he's talking there not about commands, but just in terms of how he interacts with the world. He assesses, and now is not the time for this. Well, like Pirkei Avos says, do not try to placate somebody when they're very angry. It's going to be falling on deaf ears. All right? Where Sforno is saying that it's talking about commands. And they're both true. But there's something behind both of those that King Solomon is addressing. If he has to tell you that there is a time and place for these things, what is the person's initial thought that he has to create, that he has to correct? Excuse me.
But I should blindly just follow the commandment without thinking?
No. No, if I tell you, listen, there's a time and place for everything, why do I have to tell it to you? Why do I feel a need to address you about that point? Because you might have thought otherwise. What's the otherwise?
Can I jump in here?
Please.
It seems to me that it's real easy for a person to come from a selfish perspective on me, that I'm more important and what I need needs to come first. And this is getting you outside of yourself so that you can see the bigger picture.
But what is the point about the wise-hearted person knows there's a time and there's a justice to all these matters?
Well, I was thinking about the comment about falling on deaf ears. And sometimes when somebody feels really strongly about something and the other person feels strongly about something and you're just not able to hear each other, when you're coming from that selfish place, like, you need to hear me, you want to get those things out and you want to be heard, it's recognizing the bigger picture that other person isn't in a place where they can hear you. And so you have to recognize the time that maybe things have subsided enough that they are more open to hearing you. So it's getting out of that selfish place, that me place.
Good.
Seeing the bigger picture, and that's the wisdom in it.
Right. Agreed. Good. Right. Meaning that what he's addressing here is, see, the rebelliousness of the person you were just talking about. People could be rebellious even when they're coming from their own you know, point of view, and they just don't hear the other person. But that's also a form of rebellion, where you're just stuck in your considerations, and that's it. So when he initially said in 4 that whatever the wherever the king had spoken, who's going to tell him what to do, he's that's his first maneuver in terms of showing you that your initial disposition, that desire for freedom, to be without obligation, without having to follow any type of authority, which is the infantile state, just that freedom, do what you want, and you know, I cry and I get food, or I take that toy, whatever it is, those are instincts that are part of us. And they stay with us. The question is, do we cultivate them and move them towards proper usage, or we just keep giving them free rein? So his first move in verse 4 was to say, no, God created everything. So that means that there are, you have to adapt to how the world operates in all areas. Now that could be a strong blow, because that means I can't move, I can't budge. So what will he do to help you? He'll tell you that by doing this and following God in all ways, which means that you're following all his commands, you won't know anything evil. It's going to be pleasant. Don't think that you're now forfeiting enjoyment. But then he says that he has to say one more thing to you, that there's a time and there is justice. And then the wise man knows this. What does that mean to say? That means that a person might feel that, all right, you want to tell me, King Solomon, that I've got to follow everything. But that might lead a person to feel, and have an argument, that I want to do it right now. Meaning that this is now if you're telling me that this is how the system is, so that means it should be now. There's still going to be a seed of rebellion there, that the person will want to be impulsive. And he'll say that, well, let me take it, you want to tell me that all the commands are good? Well, if I do this one right now, so I look, there's going to be, backlash, and the person could be right. The person could be right. If you're supposed to, let's say, for example, the law says that you have to rebuke your fellow brother. Right? Your fellow Jew, you have to go rebuke him. He did something wrong. The only thing is, that if you do it, so a person may say, listen, here, you want to tell me I've got to keep the Torah? Well, here's an example of something. If I do this rebuke at a certain time, it's going to backfire. So that's what King Solomon has one more qualification. He says, but the wise person knows that there's a time and there is justice to all the laws. There is a time and place. So although there is that statement that he makes, that everything which God made is good, and there's no wiggle room. You have to follow it all. So that naturally is going to give a person a feeling of he's restricted. And that's why the rabbi said the Jews after Mount Sinai and Revelation, they ran away like a child was running away from school. There was just so much. But King Solomon says, but if you have the right attitude towards it, and you see that it's all perfecting, so then you're not going to run away from it. You'll run towards it. You'll embrace it. And it won't be something that you fight any further. It's true. You're used to having freedom to do whatever you want, when you want. And now, me telling you that you have to follow everything, it may be very restricting. But number one, it'll be a good feel. But there's still one more thing the person might say. He may say, well, this XYZ command is not going to be good if I do this right now. So therefore, he has to say one more thing. An intelligent person knows when and where. There's a certain amount of how you manage. You're not controlled. Most of the day, you have free. You can do things. You say your prayers in the morning, in the afternoon, evening. You've got hours in between where it's free time. And you aren't put into, a maze where there's only one way to turn. There is freedom. But what it seems to me, what he's bringing out here is, if he has to tell you that the wise person knows there's a time, it's because a foolish person will not follow that. He's going to think that, well, if you tell me the Torah is good, that means at all times it has to be good. He takes like an absolutist type of an approach, which is not correct. People are extremists. That's what God says in the Torah. Don't add on and don't detract from the laws. Just keep them exactly. But why does he have to say, don't add on? Because evidently there is an over-religious emotion, and that can have an expression where a person is going to be using it improperly. He's going to fast. He's going to fast too much. He's not going to have energy to work, and he won't be able to survive. Because he said, oh, fasting is good. So you have to look at the whole system. You have to see that there are times and places for things. And that's crucial to know once it tells you that the entire system is something you have to follow. Because that could lead to that type of a polarized, a person that has that like polar type of tendencies. So I believe that's what he's doing. That's why it's in the same verse.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I was thinking of the laws of nature and how somebody who gets a huge desire to have tomatoes in December goes out and plants tomatoes in December.
Right.
And not recognizing the proper time for things, and they're going to get nothing, and their efforts are going to be futile.
Right, exactly. That would be a perfect example. Because there's more to it than just the law. There's sensibilities. You have examples, too. I mean, you have illustrations in the Torah of all these personalities, of all the original Noahites, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And why are these illustrations there? The person has to see in terms of how does he adapt his personality. What are the correct expressions of a human being? So you had these rare individuals, amazing as it was and how rare they were. It was just amazing. But God in his kindness recorded all these very preeminent cases and how they handled themselves and when there was a famine and what did Abraham do? And when did Abraham ask questions to God, and when did he just operate and follow his law without asking questions? So much to be unraveled. So it isn't just, here's all the laws, and a person just takes them and wants a very easy way. So you just, see, that's the easy, it's a compound. Here's the laws, I got to do them, fine, that's great, but now look what happens, it doesn't work. That's because you have to use intelligence and see how are they to be applied. When are they to be applied? That's why he says it's an intelligent person, a person with a wise heart. He knows the time and the justice. When is it just? When is it not? When is it the time for it? When is it not the time? Remember in chapter 3 of Kohelet, it's all about that. There's a time and place for everything he talked about. So he's reiterating that again. You see how, looking at his response, you have to ask yourself, well, what was he responding to when he said there's a time and place? Now we see clearly what he was responding to. He was responding to those personalities that once they've been bridled with the yoke of the Torah, so now they may just go to that extreme, okay, do everything, everything, everything. And then they just go to an extreme. No. Because then you're going to come away with misconceptions and you'll have feelings of injustice because things didn't work out properly. Well, that's because you have to see the rest of what King Solomon's telling you. There's a time, there's a place.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I'm reminded of, wasn't it at the Red Sea where God said, this isn't the time for prayer, it's time for action?
Yeah. He said to Moses, why do you cry unto me? So, yeah, the question over there, why shouldn't he cry? The Egyptians are chasing after them. Ostensibly they're going to kill him. So what God was telling him was not that he made a mistake, but God was telling him that what you're praying for is already in the works. Because what happened over there, I mean, it's really beautiful if you look at the verses. And it's always the case. You just have to take the time, look at the verses, and the story unravels. So they left at the beginning of Bashalach, and God says he didn't take them, by the way, the Philistines, lest they repent when they see the war that was going on in that area, and they'll go back to Egypt. So the question arises, why would they, if they're out of Egypt already, they left, and now they're near the Philistine area, and now there's war, so to avoid that war, they could go in any one of 360 degrees. But God says, no, if I take them this way and they see the war, so they don't have the backbone yet, so they're going to fear it, and they're going to return to Egypt. But why would they choose that path? They just got out of Egypt. So God is telling you, number one, that the reason for their return to Egypt is because they still had the mentality of Egypt being the authority, and that was safe. So that was what's going to happen. If they were confronted with something that they couldn't handle, they're going to go back to what they were used to. But God said, this is not good. So God says he took them to the Yamsuf. He took them to the Reed Sea. But why was that the right response to the Jewish nation that would tremble if they saw the war of the Philistines? Because since God has said that now that they're going to return to Egypt, and they still are carrying the authoritative view of Egypt in their minds, that means they may be physically, geographically, outside of the clutches of the Egyptians. But psychologically, they're still subservient to the Egyptian in their mind. And that can't be if I'm about to give them a Torah system. So God takes them to the Reed Sea, and the Egyptians come, and now that they want to kill them, they're worthy of death. So God takes them in, and Moses prays. And God says, now there's no reason to pray to me. But the answer is because the reason why you're here at the Reed Sea is to solve the very problem you're praying about. So there's no need, Moses. There's no need for you to pray right now. I brought you here because of the consideration that these Jews still have the Egyptians in their mind as being an authoritative figure. So I'm going to take care of that. So this way they're finally freed, not just geographically and physically from the location and subservience of a physical bondage, but now psychologically they're going to be emancipated. And when they saw the Egyptians dead on the shore, they sang out. And I believe Rashi is the one that says that they took all the clothing of the Egyptian, and that was worth more to them than the gold and silver that they plundered when they left. Because now that superior figure was nothing. They were dead. And now taking that clothing meant to say, now we can have that integrity. We can have that feeling of esteem. But there was no fault of Moses over there. He did the right thing. But he didn't know what God's plan was until God told him. You see that the verses tell you that he didn't take them by the way of Philistines because they will repent when they see war, and perhaps they'll return to Egypt. God's telling you there that that's what's going to happen, because he's trying to show you why now he has to drown the Egyptians. Because if they would choose to go back to Egypt as opposed to escaping from the Philistines by any of the other directions, they could have gone left, right, this way, that way. No, if they're going to go back to Egypt, that means there's something that still has to be addressed. And that's why he took him to the Reed Sea.
Rabbi, I wasn't clear about the, when you talked about the clothing. What was that? That's the first time I've heard that, I think.
Yeah, I believe it's Rashi that says that when they took the clothing of the Egyptians, right there, I think it was after they drowned and all the bodies washed up on the shore to show them that they're dead, in order to allow them the relief psychologically that the Egyptians are no more. But what they did was, then they took the clothing, Egyptians was either there or before they left. I'm not sure when they took the clothing, but Rashi says that the Jews valued that, the clothing, more than gold and silver that they took. Because that gave them a psychological state of now, they're the ones that can wear the, imagine you're, a peasant, and you see the king and all the royalty, and then one day you get to wear all this. Isn't that exactly what Haman wanted when he told Ahasuerus? And he thought the Ahasuerus was talking about him. What should the king do to the man he wants to reward? So Haman thought, he must be talking about me. And that's exactly what the verse says in the Megillah. So he says he should ride him around in the king's crown and the garb of the king and the king's horse and so on. Because you see, a person really values that even more than money is fame. Self-image.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. Well, you see, that shows you that the social need is very strong in human beings. That need to have the accolades of others, because that's what fame is. It means I don't feel good enough living my life, simple life, and involved in whatever I'm taking care of, my family, my small little circle. No, I've got to be as public and applauded as possible. Now I can feel good about myself. So that's a person who's not following the Torah system that says that God should really be the only one that we focus on. I've said it numerous times, that Judaism doesn't have heroes. All the flaws, the foibles of the greatest people like Moses, right, they are taught in the Torah. Because we're not deifying man. The Torah is not about people. It uses examples of greatness that people reached, but that's a stepping stone. That's just an example of how, but what was their greatness? Their greatness was their humility in place in the presence of God and searching after his wisdom. So using people to show the example of the person who does follow God. It's not, see, the world makes the mistake and they think, oh, we're just putting up the person on a pedestal and that's it. The person is the objective here. But that comes from the way we're designed. Yes, there are certain social needs. There has to be, again, it has to be that we adapt those parts of our personality to be used in the right proportions at the right times.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So, just to go back and make sure I understand the idea clearly. So when the Egyptians washed up on the shore, the people took their clothing.
I'm not sure if it was the clothing was there or was the gold and silver was there or if they took the clothing when they left Egypt. I have to see it again, but it clearly says as a Rashi that the clothing is something which gave them, they treasured that more than the gold and silver.
Oh, okay. All right. So it may have been before then. Do we know perchance if they took the clothing for practical reasons? And then it had the effect of, you know, psychologically helping them see they were now free, or whether they took it for that reason.
I think it was for that reason. That's what Moses commanded them to take the clothing.
Yeah, okay.
That they had to go out with dignity. They were slaves all the time. And it was needed that dignity was also added to the equation right now.
It seems like a truly righteous person, though, that shouldn't make any difference.
Yeah, a righteous person. A person who's a high level intellect. His clothing is not...
Right.
Right. He doesn't rely on it. That's right. That's a level. That's for sure. But there definitely was a transition at that state, so it could have been needed just to set the set the equilibrium properly. And you see that he continues with his theme in the next verse, in 6. He says, for to all desires there is a time and there is justice. For the evils of man are many upon him. All right. What are the evils? So the Ibn Ezra seems to imply at the end of his explanation, like you were saying, Doug, that it's talking not just about law, but even about just how he manages himself in life. He knows the time and place. And he says at a certain time it's not right to enter into a quarrel with a person or a battle. Because if he's being successful, it's not going to go well. And why? Because perhaps his success convinces him to keep pushing forward, and you won't win the argument. You won't win the battle because he's just too confident. And he says that the person doesn't know when the time is proper. But this he says, happens a lot. Okay. The Sforno says that there's a time and justice for all the mitzvos that God desired, blessed be he, to command. And there's a time that's fit for it and for its need for that specific mitzvah, but it's not at all times. And what do you mean justice? Means there's a time that's more proper than others. It means more just now to follow this than another time. And what does it mean that the evils of man are many upon him? So when a person's evil inclination causes him to sin, and then he has to correct that with a mitzvah to save him from the evil. So when he says that there's a time, that there's a desire, for every thing that you have to do in life, there's a time, then there's a justice to it. But what he means at the end, according to Sforno, because the evils of man are many, it means to say that the mitzvos now, why does it mean there's a time and place? Because at certain times a person sins, and he has to correct himself with a certain mitzvah, with a certain command. So he's telling you what the reason why there's a time and place. The first verse, 5, told you that there was a wise man knows, and he knows there's a time, there's a place. But now, according to Sforno, it's very smooth. Verse 5 tells you the fact that there's a time and a place, and 6 explains why there's a time and place. Because at certain times, a certain mitzvah is going to be proper to use as to address. Let's say a person was too haughty. So being friendly to people would be a good thing, a good remedy, and to help people out and to be subservient would help to diminish that arrogance. But that would only be as a response to, let's say, put more time into that, to correct that measure that he has. Certainly, a person should be nice to people at all times, but the person who sees that he has a certain trait that needs to correct, he may go out of his way a little bit more this week than last and find more opportunities which would help him subdue that. Okay, any questions or comments?
I think we're good here.
Okay. So you see how when you see him make a statement, you have to ask, well, what is he responding to? There's an unspoken disposition or sentiment that King Solomon is responding to. So it's very subtle, but even though the commands in the Torah, same thing. So we have to draw that out. Why is he saying this? The time and place. Oh, the person might, once he's bridled with the yoke of the Torah, he might feel all right. You just go to that extreme and just do it. But he won't assess that. No, he'll be too polarized. He'll be too much of an extremist. So therefore, he has to tell you in the same verse, there's a time and place. The person's wisdom will know when and where. And you see, Sforno carries it out clearly. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. That's all I had prepared for today. We covered a couple of new verses, and we see how there's a nice tie-in, there's a flow in the message that he's giving us. All right, so I guess we'll have no other questions, so we'll pick up next week, same time, right? We're on schedule.
Sounds great. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
My pleasure, always.
Thanks, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Have a great week.
Okay, everybody, have a good week.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.